Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm a host of the show. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Wolf Gruner to the show. Wolf is Chappelle Guerin Chair in Jewish Studies and Professor of History at the University of Southern California, and he's the author of a number of important books on the Holocaust. He's also the founding director at USC of the Shoah Foundation Center for Advanced Genocide Research. And today we're going to talk about his most recent book, The Holocaust in Bohemia and Moravia, Czech Initiatives, German Policies, Jewish Responses, published by Berghahn Books. It's a thorough survey of the way anti-Semitic policies emerged and played out in the Reich's protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia from 1938 to 1945. The research is remarkably thorough, but Wolf weaves his discoveries into a broader argument about the nature of persecution and what that can tell us about the broader European patterns of the Holocaust. The German edition of the book won the Sybil Halpern-Milton Memorial Book Prize from the German Studies Association in 2017, an award it richly deserved. I'm excited to have a chance to talk with Wolf about that today. So with that, thanks for joining us, Wolf, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thanks, Kelly, for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be on.
So we always start by asking our guests to say a little bit about themselves, just to introduce themselves to the audience, and in particular to say a little bit about how they became interested in the professional study of mass violence.
Yeah, so that's a long story to tell, because I have a very unorthodox way or path to academia. I grew up in East Germany behind the Iron Curtain. And my first life was actually, I was a poet and a writer, and also kind of politically distant to the regime in East Germany. So I worked in a printing office for several years, and only personal experiences actually led me to the path where I am now. And this has a lot to do with love, because my first love was half Vietnamese, half German. In East Germany. And so it's a very personal story. With her, I experienced almost frequently racial slurs in public. And I mean, I was, as you can imagine, devastated. Your first love is kind of harassed in this way, and not just once, but really frequently. So I started to kind of reading about, where is racism coming from? How does this evolve? What are the conditions or reasons for it? And so after a while, we are talking here about the end of the 70s and beginning of the 80s, it was the literature was saying more or less all the same. It was saying you have for racism to kind of evolve, it needs a state-sponsored ideology. However, this was not working in East Germany, because the East German propaganda was quite the opposite to this. It was about workers of the world unite, everybody is equal, we want a just society. So there was nothing from the state side fostering racism. However, on the ground, within the population, there was a lot of stereotyping, anti-Semitism, but mostly it was more kind of a xenophobic racism. So I, after a while, kind of not satisfied by my studies, I decided to study history to kind of sort this out myself. So this is actually how I came to study the Holocaust, because when I then applied to study history as an undergraduate at Humboldt University in East Berlin, I made a case that I want to study the Holocaust. And that's what I kind of started back then and doing still today.
So you and I chatted a little bit about this before we started. How was the experience of studying the Holocaust in East Germany, how is that different than it would have been in a Western European university?
I mean, first of all, I was a lonely writer, because nobody really studied the Holocaust except one professor whom I studied with in East Berlin. It was a lot kind of the historical studies in East Germany would say the Holocaust or the persecution of the Jews was kind of more a distraction of the masses by the kind of imperialist Nazi regime. So there was not much interest in it. But the other much more kind of influential condition for my work was that I had a personal experience of a dictatorship to kind of, and since I was kind of moving around in dissident circles and kind of cultural underground, so I had a lot of kind of personal experiences that friends were arrested, people were kind of excluded. And so these personal experiences to see how does a dictatorship actually work. And my main experience, which kind of I applied to my studies to the Holocaust, is there is not a top-down dictatorship possible. It's always kind of depending on the cooperation of a large part of the population. So that's not a kind of a small party and a terrorist or kind of a terror organization like for the Holocaust, the Gestapo or the SS. That's not working. You can't just rule with terror. That's not possible. And so there are a lot of other incentives which kind of make people either comply or even or more so being initiative within a dictatorship. So I think this kind of really shaped my approach and my view on how persecution evolves in a society, how a group is singled out, how the group is persecuted, who is participating in this and why. So there are a lot of kind of ideas I got from my personal experience.
So you're now at University of Southern California, and as I said, the founding director of the Center for Advanced Genocide Research associated with the Shoah Foundation. Could you just briefly describe that program and what you hope to do, or why you decided that this was important?
So, as I said, I had an unorthodox path, so coming to USC in 2008 was my first actually teaching job. So I got started from 0 to 100. I was never assistant professor because back in Germany, after my PhD, I decided I want to dedicate my full time to research and writing. So I lived on unemployment benefits and some grants too. And that's some people wonder why I have written so many books. That's why, because I had the time. I didn't need to teach. I was privileged in this regard. But what I developed over time was that after my fourth or fifth book, I saw that I'm already starting to repeat myself as a young scholar in my arguments or my views. And so I decided to kind of compare and branch out and look at other instances of mass violence. So I developed a deep interest in comparison, a comparative history of mass violence. And I did a kind of a second PhD, what the Germans ask for. It's called the habilitation. I did a study on the discrimination against indigenous population in Bolivia in the 19th century, where you have all the ingredients for a kind of a mass murder. You have the fierce racism, segregation policies, forced labor. So a lot of comparable elements. Even eliminationist fantasies at the end of the 19th century. However, there was no mass murder at the end. And I picked this topic exactly for the reason to make a better analysis or kind of to have the possibility for more a clearer analysis, because we are often misled when we look back from the end, the mass murder like Auschwitz, then we are kind of often misled to overlook alternatives in history. And with my topic of Bolivia, where there was no mass murder, I could see all these different conditions and elements of persecution there. And then I had to revise the question, is it really just kind of ideology which kind of leads to murder? Is there more? Are there different conditions or more conditions to it? So this kind of laid the foundation for my comparative interest. And when I came to USC, I think one of the arguments for hiring me was actually that I had not just worked on the Holocaust, but also had this comparative side. And it was USC was very supportive. I created a research cluster where I focused on the resistance to genocide, because that's also a very overlooked aspect of mass violence. that we always focus on the perpetrators, but don't really look at what people actually do against it. And this was an interdisciplinary workshop on kind of built the foundation for then the center I founded together with the Shoah Foundation, the Center for Advanced Genocide Research. So the center is a very interdisciplinary entity. It's the academic branch of the Shoah Foundation. We have a program which consists of a speaker series, annual conferences. So we had conferences on the genocide in Guatemala, music as a resistance to mass violence. We digital genocide studies. I think we did the first conference there. Last in 2018, we had the only international conference on Kristallnacht on the November Bomb, which I never expected. So, and this year we will have a conference, which I'm also very proud of. It's on mass violence and its lasting impact on indigenous communities, where I want to compare North America, South America, Australia, New Zealand, and the Pacific. So this is kind of an interdisciplinary center. We have also fellowship programs where we, on a competitive basis, we offer fellowships to PhD candidates. These are short term for a month. And our own kind of request is that they have innovative approaches to work with survivor interviews from the Shoah Foundation for their research.
Well, it sounds like a great program, and you've clearly continued your interest in comparative history, and it's brought you to this book, The Holocaust in Bohemia and Moravia. So why this book? Why did you decide to write this book at this time?
So first of all, we have to say what means at this time, because although it is published in 2016, I actually started to develop the idea for this book in 2002.
You've just terrified every graduate student who's listening to us.
No, maybe the other way around. Actually, what happened was I was at this time a postdoc at the Holocaust Museum.
Uh-huh.
I went there with a project which proposed to investigate on a microhistorical approach. Different city governments and their involvement and initiatives regarding anti-Jewish persecution in Germany. So this was a comparative microhistorical project. I got this postdoc. I went there. It was one of the best experiences I ever had. And some of my fellowship program is a little bit modeled after the Holocaust Museum's program and my own experience there, which was so beneficial because I met other people from other disciplines and so on. But what I did there was, it's probably most fellows do, you don't only do what you are supposed to do. So I'm a big archival, how can I say it, maniac maybe. Uh-huh. So I can't leave an archive without touching it. And so when I was there, I was deeply immersed in archival research. And one day I came across a collection which the Holocaust Museum had as a copy from Prague's ministries, from the protectorate. And in this moment when I saw this, I said, it's actually interesting. I found all these differences between the German city governments. And as since I have worked on Austria, where I knew that Vienna was also even more different than what happened there to German cities, I thought, I wonder what happened actually in Prague. Was there really a German dominance? Because this was the first kind of not real annexation with Germans, but it was a kind of a territory with a majority of non-Germans. So was this just kind of simple German occupation and they established a policy which was already kind of approved of in Berlin, as you can read in most literature. So I did some studies and then I realized, hold on. I mean, even before I went to the city government of Prague, I saw that the ministries, the Czech ministries, developed their own anti-Jewish measures. And I said, that's interesting. And that there was a Czech kind of how can I say this, that they were ahead of German policies there in some regards. And so that's when I thought, I should actually look deeper into this. So I actually used part of my time at the Holocaust Museum. I hope they understand this. to actually dig deep into this collection and realize that this is nobody had really investigated this. The Germans thought the Germans did everything. The Czechs said the Germans did everything. So there was kind of an understanding that there was not a big role of the Czech and also not an independent role of the Czech institutions. And this looked very different in these files. And so I said, I will write a small book which kind of analyzes the kind of very complex situation between orders from Berlin, German kind of measures from in Prague from the Reich Protector and German institutions, which are newly established there. Then what did the Czech government do? What about local policies of Czech municipalities? And then kind of mixed things where the German established kind of German mayors in Czech towns and so on. So I thought this is just a policy analysis. And I started to write. I had one third of the book written in 2010, because other projects came in between. And I was at a conference in Jerusalem. And as I said, I can't leave an archive untouched. So I was in the archive in Yad Vashem in my free time from the conference. And I made a big mistake because I asked the archivist, do you have by any chance the weekly reports from the Prague Jewish community to Adolf Eichmann? I knew they existed because I had worked with similar weekly reports in Germany, in Berlin, but also in Vienna for my research on Vienna. And I knew these are kind of incredible sources. You have to read them carefully, but they have a lot of the social reality in them of the persecution. So I was keen to see some of them at least. And then they came back and said to me, oh, yes, we have one quarter of weekly reports. And then I made the second mistake. And I said, do we have by any chance more of those? And then they said, let's find out. In the end, after 2 days, they came back to me. I had to extend my stay for, I think, 10 days. And then I was standing there taking pictures of 8,000 or 10,000 pages of weekly reports. They had all the weekly reports from summer 1939 till summer 1942. So the entire time, except one quarter, plus they had communication between the Gestapo and smaller Jewish communities in all across Bohemia and Moravia. So suddenly I had a source base which I never expected, which totally changed my game, because from a regular kind of policy analysis and showing these multiple sides, suddenly I could actually show how did this impact the Jewish population, which I never could done before in this regard. And so I thought, knowing that this exists and that I have access to it, I can't just leave it. So I thought 1 year about how can I remedy this kind of situation. So I actually, in the end, I decided I can't write this book as it was envisioned. I have to reconceptualize it. And that's what I did. And then it took another 5 years to write it. And in the end, it kind of was published in German first in 2016. And now it's kind of, we are talking about the English translation, but it's also translated into Czech and into Hebrew now.
So I'm listening to the specific word choices you're making, but I'm hearing the excitement in your voice. And I'm thinking, when you saw all that material, you didn't actually say, I have to stay another 10 days. You said something like, oh, yay, I get to stay another 10 days at the archives.
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the things everybody kind of as a researcher awaits for. And as I said, I have a deep kind of appreciation for archives from my early time on with my senior thesis. And I had made a lot of kind of discoveries over the years in archives, which often comes from very systematic work. But this time it was really an unexpected discovery. And moreover, nobody really had worked with this, with those. So nobody really knew that these exist. So to uncover them for the first time and then to be able to kind of enrich my research and my study with all these details, many of the things we had no clue of. And so I think the book is new in various different layers.
Well, let's turn to the book now. And some of the listeners may be familiar with this, but others may not. So maybe we should start with a simple question, or at least a plain question. What was the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia?
So Nazi Germany had kind of the vision to unite all ethnic Germans in a way. This led to the first to the annexation of Austria, then to the Munich Agreement, where they extended into the Sudetenland. But this Munich Agreement kind of partly destroyed the Czechoslovak Republic, which gave up a chunk of very important territory with industries, resources, borderlands. And the Germans had already developed interest in further down to occupy Czechoslovakia and also Poland. So in March 1939, the Germans kind of put a lot of political pressure on the Czech government. They gave in, as did the Austrians before, and the Germany occupied without bloodshed the Bohemia-Moravia part of the former Czechoslovak Republic, because the Slovak part had split up and got independence a little bit the day before. So now there was this big part with a lot of industries, a lot of resources and population, which then was turned into a very interesting semi-autonomous entity. So it was not like Austria. It was just pure annexed and integrated into the German Reich. This got a kind of a specific status, and this has to do what I already mentioned, that the majority was non-German. This was the first territory. So they could not expect that everybody would be happy to be part of the German Reich. So they created this semi-autonomous protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia. They granted kind of semi-autonomous status to the Czech government. There were a few fields where the Germans wanted to dictate the policy. This was foreign policy, economy, and the military. But every other kind of task of a government was left to the Czechs, including the formulation of anti-Jewish policies. And this was interesting, since we always think about like Hitler and the fanatic Nazi party. They already kind of developed this comprehensive anti-Jewish persecution over time, which, if you look closer, is not so comprehensive, and it's not well planned. It's very chaotic, but it culminated in the end in the Nuremberg Nuremberg racial laws, and then in the November program. So there is this German policy, but they don't apply this here. They leave this more or less to the Czech government, and this creates a very different perspective from where you start out analyzing what actually happened on the ground.
Mm-hmm. And so maybe it's useful to take a step back here then, given what you've just said. Long ago, I started life out as a Habsburg historian, and at least at that point, historians often depicted interwar Czechoslovakia as kind of an island of tolerance in a Central or East European ocean of illiberalism and anti-Semitism. Is that assumption true?
Yeah, so this is how I also started to approach this. So I thought, I know that this was the least anti-Semitic country in Europe at the time. That's what everybody kind of who knew this history would say. But then again, on the ground, everything is much more complicated. So there were anti-Semitic instances too. There was, let's say, from the Shoah Foundation testimonies, the interviews of survivors, you learn that in certain cities, in certain localities, Jewish pupils experienced anti-Semitism or Jewish families. But it was much more, was very complex. So some experienced never anything or don't remember it. Others say, yes, it's very clear. So there was probably more anti-Semitism than we usually would assume. But it was also very, depending on the time, because as a democratic society, the Czech government was battling kind of racism and anti-Semitism. However, in the 1930s, with the upswing of the Nazi Nazi German policies, plus its influence in the region where the ethnic Germans lived in the Czechoslovak Republic, the Sudeten, where they created kind of a large following for Hitler, this impacted also kind of the development of or the increase of anti-Semitism in the rest of Bohemia Moravia, mainly driven by Czech fascists, also as other ethnic Germans in these other areas. And then in the end, with the after the Munich Agreement, the second so-called Second Czechoslovak Republic, they already started with their own anti-Jewish measures.
One of the points you make in the book is that the number of Germans who are on the ground or routinely working in and on issues in the protectorate is really pretty small. So where do those people come from, and what where are they drawing their lessons from about how to treat this or how to deal with the people in this new territory?
Yeah, let me take also a step back. I think that's kind of a really misunderstanding what most people have about how kind of persecution evolves. So often we think about Nazi Germany as you have these kind of violent organizations like Gestapo, SS, and the Nazi Party. And then the rest of the population is more or less indifferent. The problem is the Gestapo was a very small institution. They had not, if you count all German cities, 60,000, the Gestapo had only 20,000 men. So you see, they were depending on a lot of other kind of people denouncing, like denunciations from the population, cooperation from other institutions. And very similar, you see also the circumstances then in the annexed or occupied territories, including Poland later on. So here in the protectorate, you have kind of two groups of Germans, the ones who are already there, the ethnic Germans, or who come from the former Sudeten part of the Czechoslovak Republic. And then you have the Germans who come, who are practically moved from the Reich into the new kind of newly annexed territory. So some of the ethnic Germans who are already there are kind of socialized with Nazi propaganda. They are kind of attracted to the success of the Nazi regime. So there is a lot kind of favor from there, from their side. And then you have the Reich German who are kind of mandated to go, or they kind of also look for success to go in these regions because they have more possibilities, more career chances, and so on.
And so the flip side of that, and you partially answered this already, but the officials, the Czech officials, the people running both the, I guess, the state level government in Bohemia and Moravia in the protectorate, but also people who are on the ground in towns and villages and local areas. Is there continuity in those officials between the pre-occupation period or the pre-protectorate period and the protectorate? Are these the same people or are they different?
Yeah, so the Czech government of the protectorate was kind of consisting of several ministers who were already ministers in the kind of pre-occupation phase. That means in the second Czechoslovak Republic. So there is a continuity there. The difference is that now, since the Germans are in this territory with military, there's a certain power also exercised, and the Germans demand consultations, even when they grant certain autonomy there. So you have, on the one hand, a continuity also going down to municipalities, for example, but you have then also German influence, which is, on the one hand, that they establish their own institutions like the Office of the Reich Protector, they establish Gestapo offices, they establish labor offices later on, but they also resort to the Czech expertise and institutions like forced labor, for example, is introduced by the Czech Ministry of Social Health. And so there you have practically these two sides. And the Germans sometimes also, to exert more influence, try to plant their own people into existing Czech institutions. That means, for example, in the municipality of Prague, the city government, they planted the deputy mayor. There was a German appointed to this, who was an historian, by the way, from the Sudetenland. And he was very instrumental in trying to push also anti-Jewish agendas in the city of Prague, in the capital of the former Czechoslovak Republic.
How quickly did life change for the Jews after the establishment of the protectorate?
Pretty quick, because interestingly, and here's the continuity, the first anti-Jewish measures were already enacted before the Germans even set a foot into the territory. That means it starts, the kind of this so-called Second Czechoslovak Republic starts in the fall of 1938, and this is when the first discussion evolved within the government about establishing anti-Jewish measures. So there are restrictions in the public service, and this has immediate effect that also private organizations follow suit, very similar to Germany in the 1930s. So you have the Association of Lawyers who suddenly don't want to have more Jewish members and so on. And then when the Germans are in, the first measure, as far as I know, was actually a measure of the Czech government, which targeted then mostly in the months after the Germans came, the segregation of the Jews in public and the exclusion of the Jews from public service and public offices. While the Germans were much more interested in property and the Aryanization of Jewish property.
I'm struck by, in your narrative, the relationship between the question of emigration and deportation. So could you say something about how those two intentions or imagined futures interacted in 1939 and 39 and early 40?
Yeah, so when, I mean, immigration affected or the status of immigration, the success of immigration, or the non-success of immigration affected deeply kind of the policies around the Jewish population, even before the Germans came, and then especially after they arrived. So before they came, when the Germans annexed the Sudetenland, a lot of Jews were expelled from their homes. They fled into the Czech part, in the remaining Czech parts of the territory. So there was suddenly what we today call very similar to then a refugee crisis. And as we also know today, these so-called crises are partly manufactured and then instrumentalized for political purposes. And that's exactly what happened in 1938 and 1939 from the Czech side, that this was used to kind of establish anti-Jewish measures before the Germans even came, because there was this influx of Jewish refugees. And then when the Germans are there, interestingly, you would assume at the point in time, everything was kind of used, or every method was used or established by the German or implemented to expel the Jews out of the German territory. However, what they did when they arrived in Prague is, although they shut down first all the Jewish institutions, and then, as it would happen, as it had happened in Vienna, it was not that they pushed out the Jews as fast as possible. They actually forbade the immigration of Jews from Prague or from the Czech territories. That means, therefore, a lot of Jews tried to kind of go over the green border, so to speak, legally, because officially they could not immigrate. And that's very kind of a very particular situation, because why would they forbid? But there's a very simple reason. These refugees would have kind of, would it made it harder for German Jews to kind of flee the country or emigrate, because they would compete over resources, transit visa, train tickets with the German Jews. And the Gestapo and the security service of the SS, they wanted to have the German Jews out first. So that's why for the first months, there was a prohibition of immigration. But then when the war loomed with Poland, the Germans kind of got into detailed preparation for the invasion, the Gestapo kind of changed their approach and said, for us, it's important to get as many Jews out as possible before a war starts. And so they changed their policy. So you see, this is very much connected. And the outcome was not only to now suddenly allow immigration from Bohemia and Moravia, but also Prague and Brno, they were both cities which were included in the first deportation program which was ever established in Nazi Germany, which was way earlier than most people assume, which practically happened in October 1939. This means only a few weeks after the invasion of Poland. And several thousand Czech Jews were among the 5,000 Jews who were deported from Vienna, from Upper Silesia and Bohemia Moravia to the east of the newly conquered Polish territories.
And was the intent to continue, or how did that end? How did that initial deportation end up being stopped?
Yeah, so the literature usually assessed this in a way and saying, this was driven by Eichmann. They understood Eichmann as the Austrian guy who ran the Central Office for Jewish Immigration in Vienna. And widely, historians agreed that this was a kind of an individual, independent maneuver of Eichmann. My sources actually tell a very different story. I have found sources where the plan was more a pilot, so to speak, or the beginning of a large-scale deportation. So, for example, one document talks about the deportation of 300,000 Jews from Greater Germany, which includes German, Austrian, and Czech Jews. Another document says the deportation of the German Jews will start in November. However, this first deportation wave was stopped by the head of the SS, by Himmler, in the beginning of November. So just the moment when the Germans should enter the scheme, because there were technological problems. They had infrastructure problems to get the people to the east. And so they stopped this and postponed this for several months to the next spring. And often we see history from the end. So for us, this was kind of not the beginning of the big deportation, because the big deportation started 2 years later for us, because we see the actual result. But you have to think about these alternatives. And if you look at it, the actual plan to deport most of the German Jews, including the Austrians and Czechs, was set already in September, October 1939, a few weeks after the invasion of Poland.
So then you have this period that lasts, a couple years, give or take, where deportation may be an idea, but is not a reality. And so how does the dynamic of policymaking toward Jews in the Protectorate, how does that work in those 2 years? Is it is it possible to say that local autonomous efforts were more significant than centralized efforts, or vice versa? How would you assess that, and what happens?
Yeah, so kind of as a result of all of my studies combined, I can say that one has to look at the persecution of the Jews as a kind of a multi-institutional effort. So a lot of agencies and institutions were involved. It was never just kind of Hitler. It was never just the SS. It was a huge variety of different administrations and institutions, which often worked in a kind of a division of task area where every institution's kind of looked at one field. There are differences between kind of central policies and local policies. And I think this shows a little bit, but also what happened then in Prague. The only central area we are talking about, which was always managed from Berlin, was deportations. And since the deportations were stopped in the fall of 1939, suddenly there was this, I would not say vacuum is too strong a word, but there was this gap or this kind of lack of developed plans what now to do, because the expectations were, first, they would be deported, so we don't need to do anything. Then they postponed the deportations. That means in a few months they will be deported, so we don't need to really establish things. So for one measurement for this is that in Bohemia Moravia, there is not an immediate establishment of forced labor, which is kind of counterintuitive, because forced labor was introduced against German Jews as a measure to remedy the problem of unemployment on the one hand, and on the other hand of decreasing income for Jewish families. And at the third moment, to extract as much kind of economic resource from the remaining Jews as possible. So you would assume the same would apply for, would have been applied by the Germans in the Protectorate. But no, they expected they would be deported, so it didn't really make sense to establish a big forced labor program. So this kind of a direct impact on how the anti-Jewish policy developed differently than in other regions. And that's what I think, why it is so important. What I try in the book is always to compare these developments in different areas between what happened in Germany at the same time, in the same area, what happened in Austria, and what happened also in parts of Poland, of occupied Poland. And here you see that we have to kind of think about much more complex developments, which really kind of diminish the role of this ideological fanatism and bring in much more to the forefront economic considerations, social issues, differences between institutions, local initiatives. And so it makes the whole story so much more complicated. But what it also does is doesn't kind of let people off the hook, because you see then when you look at all these different institutions, how many more people were involved in the persecution of the Jews than we've previously assumed.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you, so maybe the way to phrase this is to say, how did ordinary Czechs respond to these anti-Semitic policies and practices?
I would say also in a very different way. So you find, for example, Czechs in Prague who write letters to the city government or to the Nazi Party branch because they are interested in Jewish apartments. But you have also Czechs who kind of support Jewish families when they want to flee across the border or with other means. So as in every society, you have a very also complex variety of attitudes. But also, I have to say, I think I want to make a point that this attitudes change and they depend on situations. So what we learn from perpetrator studies during the last 20 years, it is not that people act always the same way. We have now research results which point to that perpetrators acted also as rescuers because they are in a different situation, they are approached. So it's less about the character, it's much more about the overall conditions, the situation, the relationships between people, which determine what people do in what kind of part of the timeline, so to speak.
If non-specialists know anything about the protectorate, it's probably Reinhard Heydrich. So why is Heydrich brought in, and how does his presence change policy?
Yeah, so Reinhard Heydrich, as the head of the German police and the security service of the SS, he is in. It's interesting. I mean, he is a household name for Nazi crimes, and I think maybe we should also say, you just mentioned people don't know so much about the protectorate. The only thing what people know is the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich, right? And then probably also Ghetto Theresienstadt. And this is interesting. There is I think it's motivated by that there is not much interest in Czech affairs in general. So that's much more the attention to the German part, because Heydrich was brought in from Germany to kind of really sort things out in the protectorate. And the Theresienstadt as a ghetto was only interesting because a lot of German Jews ended up being there. So there is also kind of, I would say, German centrism in research, which kind of played out. And that's also what I wanted to change with my book. That's why my book doesn't talk much about the Theresienstadt ghetto, because I wanted to really investigate what actually happened to the Jewish population before they were deported. And Reinhard Heydrich, in a way, is brought in because the Czech population to a large degree was not friendly as the Austrians were to the Germans. They felt occupied. There was resistance. There was sabotage. There were underground groups. And then at a certain point, there were big demonstrations against the Germans. So he is brought in to kind of really rule with a much more draconian manner to quell any kind of potential mass scale resistance. And part of what he does is also he tries to centralize anti-Jewish measures, which speaks to the fact that before he comes, a lot of the anti-Jewish measures were, this is what I show in the book, were initiated, implemented and executed by kind of Czech administrations and Czech people in certain areas, sometimes where kind of existing policies are adopted, but not always. They are also kind of adopted in a way that they apply to the special circumstances in Bohemia Moravia. So this tells us also that when you look at Europe as a whole and the persecution of the Jews, that we have to look at all of these different countries and territories in a more microscopic way to understand why certain persecution measures were introduced at certain points, but not always at the same point in time, or not always at the same kind of part of the persecution timeline, if you want to call it this. So there are different trajectories which are very much influenced by local conditions, local cooperation, local interests, and also by the development of the war in general. So there are very complex interplay of different conditions which influence the persecution on the ground.
And so can you say the same about the Jewish response to persecution?
Yeah, that's actually the interesting part. So first, most historians had a kind of understanding that Jewish resistance is more or less kind of defined by organized group settings. And people think about resistance often in a way that this needs to be armed. So when we talk about the Holocaust, the only thing what comes to mind for people as resistance in general is the Warsaw ghetto uprising and the partisans in Eastern Poland and the occupied Soviet Union. This was up for debate since the Second World War kind of ended, because, I mean, survivors, but also Israeli historians point to the fact there was so much more what needs to be perceived as resistance, like spiritual resistance, the conversation of religion, of Jewish culture, education. And extending these ideas, I kind of developed a much broader approach to resistance, looking at what the individual actually could do and did against the implementation and advancement of these the anti-Jewish persecution. And this is coming back to the beginning of our conversation, was very much influenced by my own personal experience in East Germany. Since I was part of the underground, I know that the regime is looking at outsiders or people who are opposing the regime in general, in a way that anything what you say, anything what you do, can be judged as hostile to the regime. So it's not that you need to take up arms to be identified as kind of an opponent. It starts so much more earlier. So that's why people in dictatorships, it's a problem. Can you talk to everybody when you are saying this? How is this recognized? Will people denunciate you? Are there informants? So practically everything what you do and what you say needs to be evaluated by yourself. What are the repercussions? What are the risks? Not just for yourself, but also for your family, your friends. So in this way, applying this personal experience, I define Jewish resistance extremely broad, because any kind of circumventing, ignoring Jewish measures is practically resistance, since the Germans, the Nazis, they punished Jews for exactly doing this, like ignoring laws, not wearing the star, not applying for the forced middle name. These were perceived as resistance acts, and they were punished. So my understanding is so much broader, I'm able to show this because when we know the diversity of anti-Jewish measures, we can understand how the Jews actually also reacted in a very diverse manner, because the circumstances and the kind of the things they have to respond to are so different.
So, as you say in your conclusion, out of the approximately 118,000 Jews who lived in Bohemian Moravia in 1938, only about 14,000 were left to see the end of the war. And I know this is a broad general question, but I'll phrase it and you can summarize as you wish. What happens to those 14,000?
So I didn't do so many kind of intensive studies on the post-war period. But interestingly, Czech Jews, some of them were actually persecuted as being Germans after the war, which is extremely ironic and macabre in a way. So because they spoke German, and that's where they kind of have to suddenly wear armbands like the Germans. And others kind of went back to their homes, but their homes were either destroyed or they were occupied by Czechs. So they couldn't go back. And then many, in a way, kind of leave the Bohemia Moravia and go either to Palestine or to the United States or other territories where they still have family. And some stayed.
So we're about out of time for this discussion. Are there what lessons, and you've already named several, but are there other lessons you want to highlight that you've drawn from this study that we should think about in thinking about the Holocaust or other genocides?
Yeah, just maybe to repeat, I think what this study shows is that persecution of a group, if you want to generalize it, is only partly motivated and explainable by the existence of a kind of a racist ideology. There are so many other factors which influence the cause of the persecution, the implementing of anti-Jewish measures, that we have to talk about. For example, that over the course of persecution, opportunities are open for people to participate. So when Jews lose their jobs or their shops, other people can benefit. When you work in a city government and you are not even kind of a fanatic anti-Semite, but the setting is like this, you are tend to kind of exclude Jews as the weakest element, so to speak, when you have to distribute resources. So there are things which we have to incorporate in our analysis, economic factors, social factors, political factors, which really kind of shape how persecution starts, develops, and in the end plays out against the Jewish population.
Well, at this point, normally in the interview, I would be getting ready to say goodbye. To use a sports metaphor, that's not really appropriate now. It's more like halftime, since Wolf will be joining me again along with a co-editor for discussion of another book here in the next few weeks. But maybe we'll just end this interview by asking you to say, to suggest to the audience a book or two or a movie or something that was meaningful to you that you would recommend to the audience.
Yeah, so, I mean, one book which helped me over the course of of writing the book was actually the diary of a young boy in Prague, which I cite in the book several times. It's called Peter Ginz's The Prague Diary. And it's published in different languages. The English translation is not as good as the German one. But it just shows really how a teenager experienced, who is a good observer, experienced practically the changes you were asking about. And in his own family, with his parents, with his neighbors, with the friends of the family, with the Jewish community. So there's a lot of detail in this diary, which you normally don't get, even in diaries from other teenagers, which we know because they talk just about their family. But I think it's very special here that there is this kind of, that he describes a lot of the developments with a lot of insights to the Jewish community. So you see not just individual reactions, but also collective reactions of the Jewish community.
Yeah, I saw that in your notes.
Can I just kind of say it?
Please.
And I'm so interested in this because what I think you asked me what I would add about what is special about the book in my view. So Saul Friedlander was asking for 20 years that historians should write integrated histories. That means not just looking at the analysis of the perpetrators, but really also include the voices of the victims. And a lot of historians kind of heed to the call. I think what I do in the book is actually going one step beyond this call, and I call this integrative history. What I try to do is here to combine not just not just to include the voices of the victims, but really to show them as historical agents, as active people who react to the persecution, sometimes even try to prevent it or to resist it. And I think that's what I'm most proud of in this book, to bring these two in a very active way together, not just as an illustration of voices.
And that is both the reason why the book is so good and a reason why it's perhaps so hard to isolate in a series of questions in an interview. So I would encourage everybody listening to go read it. It's a wonderful book. And Wolf, I'll press pause for the moment. Thank you so much for joining me today. And I look forward to having you back in a few weeks to talk about another book.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much.